I'm joined today by Anthony Del Rio. Anthony is the president of Rush Health, the clinically integrated network of Rush University System in Chicago. Prior to joining Rush, Anthony represented healthcare clients at an international law firm with a focus on mergers and acquisitions. In this episode of Tuning Healthcare, Anthony and I discuss the movement to risk and how he is focused on enabling Rush to take more risk, how health systems deliver the scale and network to aggregate thousands of physicians and hundreds of thousands of lives, how he believes the health system clinically integrated network will have a greater long-term impact on healthcare than the primary care aggregators, and the advice he would give to his younger self would be to take chances. Join Anthony and me as we tune healthcare. Anthony, thank you for joining us today. I'm really delighted to have you on the Tuning Healthcare podcast. Really excited to get your perspective of somebody who runs a large clinically integrated network of free primary care aggregators and the evolution of the sort of what at Lumeris we call the accountable physician has really gathered steam. And so your perspective is going to be fascinating. And also the first time I think we've had a fellow lawyer and definitely a fellow reformed lawyer on the podcast. So Anthony, welcome and thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. No, thank you for having me, Nigel. I'm happy to be here and I'm happy to share our experiences of suffering through law and moving on to greener pastures.
Excellent. So before we jump into topics that are currently facing the industry and challenges and opportunities that you see in front of Rush, tell us about your background. Obviously, we've covered that you started in law and how did you end up in healthcare?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, and so, you know, my interest in healthcare actually did predate my time in law. My undergrad, I studied business and my focus was actually healthcare. And at the time, you know, full transparency, my focus was healthcare because in, you know, my head as thinking as a, you know, a 20-year-old, I was like, well, healthcare is nearly 20% of our GDP. If I go into healthcare, surely I'll have a good job. And so I, that was a big area of interest. I studied a lot. I did finance specifically and, you know, I did pretty well. But coming out, I had a lot of professors that were encouraging me, hey, you should go to grad school. You know, you've done very well. I think you should go into kind of a higher level here, get a graduate degree. And at the time it was like, well, you know, do I go and get an MBA? And it's like, well, no, because you really need to have some really good work experience before you go to get an MBA. And I had some management experience, but not really stuff that I would view as criteria to go to an MBA program. And someone kind of steered me towards law. And because I had some interest in policy along with kind of the business side of things. And so I went to law school and I out of law school, I had a great time in law school, learned a lot. I also spent some time with HHS, General Counsel's Office, and also the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, because I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia. And for my time there, it was really great. But, you know, as with most of my classmates, I didn't go into government work. I went to a kind of private law firm. And I had, you know, your traditional healthcare clients tended to be more community hospitals, large physician groups. And it was a great experience. But my wife, who I met during law school, was actually an MD-JD. And so she was finishing up her MD while I was practicing. And she went through the whole kind of match program and ended up matching at University of Chicago for residency. And I was in Atlanta at the time. My firm was in Atlanta. We didn't have a Chicago office. And so I started looking for jobs. And unfortunately, this was right around the downturn. And so it was, you know, 2010. And finding legal jobs during that window was a little challenging, as one might expect. And I lucked out that there was a consulting firm that did healthcare consulting that I saw, and I, you know, I sent in my stuff and they called me in and I flew in and did an interview. And it was this nice alignment of, you know, they were looking for someone with regulatory expertise, but also, you know, kind of business side, finance, management expertise. And I was kind of a unique marriage of that. And so they made me an offer, I accepted. And I went into consulting for a few years doing that work. And it was like a nice hybrid of legal and business. And I was on the ground working with a lot of AMCs, doing kind of development work and management work. And healthcare is so heavily regulated that my legal background was very helpful in that. And I, you know, developed several hospitals, developed new programs, you know, helped manage programs. And it was a fantastic experience. But then after a few years, as tends to happen, my wife and I, we had a child. And suddenly flying around the country doing consulting work was a little more challenging. And so I did the thing, which I still get made fun of by some of my law friends, was I went back to a big law firm because I had a kid, which is normally not the course you go. But then I went back to a large healthcare firm doing healthcare M&A and regulatory work for several years after that. And I did a lot of deal work. And at first I was doing hospital work, but then over time, and you guys are probably very familiar with this, a lot of private equity money started flowing into the healthcare world. And so my kind of work started pivoting more to private equity, you know, physician aggregators, actually. And so I was doing a lot of kind of physician roll-up work with various PE-backed, VC-backed platforms, and getting away from hospital kind of centric work. And as I, you know, as a shifted from hospital work to more PE work, it was just less interesting and more rote. And I lost touch with it. And so I started looking again, and I went to, I interviewed with kind of several large AMCs. I ended up going with Rush University Medical Center. At the time it was Rush University Medical Center. And since I joined Rush in the legal department, and head of their healthcare transactions group, and the Rush became a system. And so Rush University System for Health, and now it has three hospitals. And one of the final deals I did in my legal role was acquiring our clinically integrated network, which is Rush Health. And so I led the deal of acquiring Rush Health into the Rush system. And once we did that, there was kind of a search for leadership to take over that role. We did an external search, and I got, you know, several people coming to me within our organization saying, hey, you did this deal. You know so much about this. Your prior experience in consulting really aligns with this. You know, is this something you'd be interested in? And again, it goes back to being kind of that nice marriage of a lot of regulatory things, but then also kind of the business operation strategy side. And I said, absolutely. And that was a little over a year ago. So it was funny, actually, because part of my pitch during my interview for why I'd be good is like my vision of what we could be, what this clinically integrated network could be, and, you know, our pivot to value and risk. And, you know, a lot of that was kind of more theoretical at the time. And people were like, oh, that sounds cool. Yeah, let's have them explore that. And then the pandemic hit. And all of a sudden, you know, having, you know, risk and capitation based reimbursement versus fee for service reimbursement became very attractive. And so kind of supported my thesis there. But, you know, it's been a great journey. You know, we're very strategically focused on how we're going to grow our network, how we're going to be successful, and kind of where healthcare needs to be. And so this move away from fee for service to value, but that's been my journey here. You know, it's been great. I'm so happy to be here. And you know, I don't miss my days of doing healthcare M&A work, but it was, you know, I think the legal background was a great building block to be successful, because healthcare is so heavily regulated and there's so much going on that it was a good framework, but I'm happy to be more focused on business and strategy now.
Yeah. So I always find that, the legal training obviously didn't stay in law anywhere near as long as you did. But I always found there were three main things in my legal training that have held me in really great stead during my business career. And I would say the three are, first of all, you know, there's an analytical capability that is sort of ingrained in you through both the study and practice. And so that, I think, is the ability to sort of take in data and analyze it, I think, is a great skill set. The second is just attention to detail, right? And we know when we execute, it's all in the detail. And so that you know, I remember the first partner I worked for being like really pedantic about you know, every piece of grammar, where a stop was, where a comma is. And so, I mean, even to that level of detail, which might sound boring and a waste of time, but it sort of trains you in attention to detail. And the third is negotiation, right? You're involved in negotiating almost every single day of your life, which is just critical because you know now as the leader of your clinically integrated network, you're negotiating every single day of your life, whether it be with physicians, whether it be with colleagues, whether it be with payers. I mean, it's a massive part. So I always felt those three things have, and you added a fourth, right, which is sort of comfort with sort of the whole regulatory environment, have really held me in great stead. And perhaps sometimes undervalued. I actually think it's in many ways some great skill sets as you move into your role. So you touched on a lot of great things that I would love to delve into. So let's delve into one of them first, which was the move to value. And you know, I've said on this podcast before, healthcare has always had the reputation for being recession-proof, but it turned out not to be pandemic-proof. And so, as you correctly said, if you have a greater percent of your reimbursement in value-based care, you were much more protected through the pandemic than if you were reliant on fee-for-service. So tell us a little bit about, obviously, you staked your claim for the job on the move to value. Where is your clinically integrated in this journey? How much risk do you take? How do you see the evolution? Tell us a little bit, delve a little bit deeper for us into sort of value-based care.
Yeah, absolutely. And so where we currently sit, Rush Health, we've got probably a little over 2,000 providers that are in our CIN, 2,200-ish. We've got four hospitals. Three of them are Rush-owned, so Rush Hospitals. One of them is an independent hospital that's still in you know, the Illinois market. And so that's our network size. We have all other various kind of ambulatory facilities and things like that too, kind of around the edges. And we're a little unique in that we have all of the contracting functions sit within our CIN. And so that includes our fee-for-service contracts with, you know, the commercial payers. It includes our value, you know, value-based contracts with the payers, but then also our government programs too. And so right now we've got, in terms of value, we have our Medicare ACO, which has roughly 30,000 lives in it. We've got MA contracts in place that have about another 5,000 lives. We have a commercial ACO with a major payer in the market. That has about 60,000 lives. And then we also have a Medicaid product through a Medicaid MCO that we're at risk for that has about another 15,000 lives. And then we also manage our self-insured employee population that's covered under our system. And so subtotal together, it's probably 120,000, 130,000 lives. They're all at different points though. So on Medicare, you know, we're at risk, but there are various kind of caps and protections around upside and downside. And we, you know, we split that with Medicare. It's not full risk. It's not capitation. It's kind of somewhere in between. On the commercial side, we're also at risk, but again, we have kind of buffers for upside downside. That one is benchmarked based on prior year costs. And so we have kind of a PMPM that's assigned to, you know, that population to say, okay, last year it was this year our target is, you know, it's mainly on the commercial side is to control costs. And so we're not looking to say, hey, spend less this year than you spent last year. But if you keep it below X increase or X increase in percent, then we'll see upside shared savings. Or if we just blow through it and we end up, you know, having an increase in cost of, you know, 8% or something, then we would owe some kind of a downside payment back. Medicaid population is more similar to kind of your Medicare ACO in that, you know, we are at risk. We have some PMPM dollars around care management. And then our self-insured employee population is really, you know, that one is capitated in a way because it's our money. And so we, you know, we try to manage that one similar to how we manage our Medicare population. So make sure, you know, try to make sure they stay out of the ED, get appropriate site of care, manage chronic conditions. But it's a lot of really cool opportunities to leverage, you know, our pop healthcare management resources with our own employees. Because, you know, really, if we're not comfortable that it's going to be successful with our own staff, we probably shouldn't be using it with other populations.
Right. And where do you see it going? Do you see yourself being taking more and more risk and a greater percent of the premium dollar? How do you see that evolving for you guys?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I made the 18 months I've been here, I've made a big push to get into pathways to risk. And so we flipped to downside for both on commercial and our Medicare populations this year. We're going to push more aggressively. So on MA, on our MA products right now, it's upside only for the most part. But we're pushing those into downside over the next couple of years as we get to, you know, what I'd call critical mass in terms of kind of lives attributed to those programs. We're also still want to make sure we pick the right MA partner because there's a lot of, obviously, well, you're well aware, there's a lot of MA players. And so right now, most of our Medicare sits in our ACO. And once we feel like we have good contracts in place on the MA side, I think we'll start saying, yeah, here's who we're going to work with. You know, we have shared risk, you know, shared premium dollars, kind of aligned interest around what we're trying to achieve with the population and how we think we're going to get there. But yeah, then I would see us getting into more downside risk. And the goal too is where we sit structurally within our system is my company, Rush Health, is a direct subsidiary of the system, so the system parent. And then the hospitals are kind of sister corporations to me and the physician groups too. And so our ultimate goal is to have, you know, Rush Health be a you know, value generator for the system. And so a diversification of revenues. And so while, you know, the hospitals are predominantly reliant on fee-for-service, as we're successful in our pivot to risk, Rush Health will generate dividends for the system through, you know, this value proposition and being successful in managing populations. And so that way, you know, knock on wood, if there's ever another pandemic or something along those lines. And we saw this year too. I mean, Rush Health, my numbers look great because I already had risk populations within my product and my programs. But obviously our hospitals suffered a great deal. And so the system as a whole had a very rough year because of the pandemic and care avoidance. But the goal would be, you know, diversify our revenue streams and also like create different value for our hospitals to serve. And so recognizing that as the Rush Health Network grows and our at-risk population grows, no matter what, there are still going to be patients that need brain surgery or heart surgery. Things are still going to happen and the hospitals are going to be there. And they're going to be fully aligned with that value proposition to make sure you're bringing kind of the highest quality and the best value care to those patients. And so I think that's where I would differentiate ourselves from like aggregators. So, you know, Oak Street, for example, there's not a hospital that's a part of their, you know, their system. And so you can only do so much to align when you don't have a hospital that's really contributing to that mission. And here, because we have this great mix of hospitals and our network, we can all become fully aligned with saying, yeah, here's how we deliver the best care at any level. So any level of acuity, because with our system, we've got everything from, you know, you got a cough, you got sniffles to you have, you know, an aneurysm. We're going to have you covered in your whole journey. And I think that's the real value we can bring. And that's our push. So yeah, over the next 5 years, we plan to very aggressively expand, you know, what portion of our overall revenue is accounted for under risk, you know, risk-based programs.
Yeah. So it's fascinating, right? I'd love your perspective here. You touched on the primary care aggregators. Obviously, they have garnered a lot of attention in both the media and the from public investors recently, and some high valuations, and it's an interesting model, right? Because in effect, you're delivering the same business, right? You manage physicians, you manage lives, but in one market, you're doing it at larger scale than probably any single one of them. And you do it with obviously the what I consider the network to support you, right? The health system and other pieces of the network, ambulatory you mentioned before, right? And so tell us your thoughts, okay? Because you're in the same business, but you're doing it in one market at greater scale and to obviously what they're doing in multi-markets. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on from just a business model, model of care. What's your perspective?
Yeah, I think I very much respect, you know, their model and what they're bringing. I think it's important to push all of healthcare towards a greater value proposition. And so I just want to say that I think the valuations are very high. And so I think looking at kind of the business behind it, you know, just knowing like what it's going to take to get there. And I get a lot of it's probably prospective of, you know, we're buying into this model idea. And as they reach scale, you know, the value will match up with where they're getting to. I think my concerns with the model from, I would say, kind of a healthcare delivery standpoint are kind of twofold. One is it's focusing on a narrowed population, and you're taking primary care doctors out of kind of the larger picture and saying you're going to be focused on these MA patients. And so now, you know, this is your sole responsibility, manage these Medicare Advantage patients. And follow this model and, you know, use this technological solution that we have. And this is how you do it. And, you know, we're going to be successful. And ultimately, you know, I think their goal, and this is rightfully so, you know, for their corporate structure, deliver value to their shareholders. And so they feel like they've come up with a model that will successfully allow them to take on, you know, these patient populations at risk and deliver value to their shareholders. I think most of it is probably through kind of focused on arbitrage at the hospital level. And certainly that exists. You know, I'm you know, a health system executive, but I will absolutely admit there's definitely opportunities to do better at hospital utilization. That being said, once you squeeze that, where are you going? And my concern is their model is so focused on hospital arbitrage. And by that, I mean, let's do everything we can to keep these patients out of the hospital. That only gets you so far. And then also, what does that do to the larger kind of continuum of care and patient needs? Because again, sometimes patient needs to be there. And sometimes, and I'll use this as an example, and I won't name names, but I'm aware of a kind of a patient in another market where they were part of one of these programs and they had kind of an ongoing condition. It was a very unique condition. It was related to brain, so neuro, neurological, and the aggregator did the best they could to keep that patient from having to go to an AMC. But that led to a waterfall of issues where when that patient did eventually end up in an AMC, the AMC immediately said, whoa, this is X, Y, and Z. This is how we need to handle this. But that was after literally weeks of suffering because they were trying to do their best to keep the patient in the lowest cost level of care rather than saying, wait, this actually does need that academic medical center touch. Because the reality is there are things that come up that need that. And these physician aggregators are so focused on kind of leveraging that hospital arbitrage and keeping patients out of the hospital that things are going to get missed and it's going to negatively impact the patients. And ultimately, and this goes back to the kind of the mission question, you know, my corporate mission is delivering care to the community and making sure we successfully do that. And we've been doing that for 150 years and we're going to keep doing that. And so there's just different alignment. But I think that's my biggest concern, but I very much, you know, their model is important and it's pushing the envelope and it's pushing the narrative, But I do see, you know, higher value in managing the whole continuum of care for the patient's needs.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating topic. And like you, I respect anybody that gets up every day and is in the business of trying to improve healthcare in the country. And so I'm reminded of a story once. A company came to meet with us in St. Louis, after a day of discussing how we might be able to partner, the CEO of this company said, you know, we've been considering it, and we think we're too competitive. And sort of we looked at them and said, you know, in a multi-trillion dollar healthcare industry, you really believe that your $50 million company and our company have more room to compete than we have to partner. And so from my perspective, I come at it from my mindset is anyone who gets up every day and is in the business of trying to improve healthcare, you know, all respect to you. But as we think about, you know, I've been in, you know, spent the last 12 years thinking about, you know, value-based care and what are the models, right? And how do we scale this to the country? What, the reason that I think that, you know, what you're doing at Rush and what other health systems are doing and what more health systems need to do and I think will do over the next few years, is more both scalable and impactable to healthcare in this country, for me, comes down to four things. I think one is the scale, right? We've already just touched on the fact that in your one market, your scale is bigger, right? And so the impact that you have and the ability for you to have a continued impact is enormous, right? Today, you're servicing 130,000 lives, right? You know, everybody that comes within the Rush network, and if that network continues to grow, is going to be significantly greater than that, you know, as you roll the clock forward, right? And so that's the scale is one. Second is you've got the best brand in healthcare, right? And, you know, in every market you go to, the health system is almost always the best brand. And where would you rather receive your healthcare from than Rush, right? Or pick another healthcare system in another market, right? So the brand you have is excellent. The third is a really critical one, a topic that's close to my heart, is just you sort of touched on health equity, right? And you're in the business of really managing populations, right? Not segments of populations, which I think is the mission of the health system. And then the fourth and also really critical is to manage populations, you need a network. Right. And the more there's so much research on this, the more that you keep care within a high performing network, the better the outcomes are for the patient. And so you have that network, you know, ready to go because you've got three hospitals, you've got an ambulatory system, you've got, you know, whatever it was, what do you say, 2000 physicians, right? So you have this network ready to go. You've got specialists who are absolutely needed as part of the sort of delivery of complete and excellent healthcare. And so, to my mind, I, you know, total respect for the aggregators, and we need, as you say, people to push the envelope. I think the model you're on, for sort of some of the reasons you said, plus the four that I added, I think is we're going to see have a much greater impact on sort of healthcare nationwide rather than sort of, you know, in market A and B. So that's just my perspective.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think a big part of it too is going back to the question about kind of the health equity in different communities. You know, ultimately, if we start segregating populations in terms of, okay, these, we're going to aggregate, you know, 400 PCPs in this market, and those PCPs are going to be the highest performers, and we're going to focus them on these MA populations, it negatively impacts everyone else. And also it negatively impacts the doctors. And so my wife, who is a PCP, you know, it's so funny. I'm lucky to have her perspective because I always can draw on her to understand, you know, what the needs of the providers are and what will help them be successful. And, you know, she's actually MedPeds trained, so internal medicine and pediatrics board certified. And so she sees the entire gamut. So from, you know, the 3-year-old to, you know, the 80-year-old. And it's so important for her to see those kind of wide range of populations because there are all these different problems that come up, but it shapes you as a physician. And it also shapes your happiness because it's funny, she'll come home and she would tell me, you know, God, if I only had to see peds patients, it would get so boring. Or, you know, if I only had to see, you know, the geriatric patients, then it'd get so boring. And you know, you lose touch because suddenly that's all you know about the healthcare, you know, continuum is that sole population. And as you follow patients throughout their whole life, you're able to see the bigger picture and all the things that are impacting them. And it's more fulfilling for the physician provider. And it's better for the patient too, because then they have this whole track record of I've been with this has been my PCP. This is my PCP. And I can't imagine, you know, taking, you know, our providers and our PCBs and saying, I'm sorry, your panel is only going to be Medicare Advantage patients now. And there are people in our market doing that. Literally only Medicare Advantage. So if that patient is on a Medicare product, it's just Medicare fee for service, you're not going to see that patient anymore. And you're commoditizing healthcare and that relationship between doctor and patient to a degree that I don't think is healthy for anyone, other than I guess the shareholders potentially. But you know, that's my other concern there, because you know, what our network does is, and this is helpful, is we leverage our success on our Medicare population to say, okay, how do we apply that to our Medicaid population? Or how do we apply that to our commercial population? Because ultimately, our employee population, ultimately, there are all these things we can learn from these different populations, and we can apply across the spectrum and say, you know, what works and what doesn't, and let's make everyone healthier. Let's make everyone healthier. And ultimately, that's our goal.
Right, and which is why over time you'll be impacting hundreds of thousands of lives, which is obviously incredible, and something we, you know, need of across the country, and obviously not just in Chicago. As you look at these sort of trends that have, you know, been catalyzed, if you like, by the pandemic, you know, more access digitally, care moving to the home. You know, obviously you mentioned before the sort of care avoidance, which is obviously a major concern. Mental health is the concern, so it's just exploded. We had a crisis before the pandemic. We probably now have a real national crisis around mental and behavioral health. So a lot of things have sort of evolved. Which trends do you see sort of being boomerangs, and which ones do you see being frisbees? So which ones will be just pandemic, flash in the pan, and we'll revert back to the way we were? And which ones do you see being things that will last through healthcare as we move into the next sort of, you know, 3, 5, 10 years?
Yeah. So the ones that are boomerangs have already become pretty evident for us. And so a lot of the kind of surgical-based procedures tanked because people stopped, you know, for a lot of reasons. Part of it was care avoidance. Part of it was people weren't doing things that injured them. And so for, you know, orthopedics all of a sudden just completely fell off. Part of that was because people stopped playing sports. You know, all of that type of stuff, I think, is bouncing back as people return back to their communities and engage in these activities again. The downside on that kind of stuff, though, and which is kind of scary, is around kind of oncology and neurological issues and some heart issues. We've seen a lot of that is care avoidance in those spaces led to more acute issues surfacing. And so, you know, looking at our current data, we're seeing this spike in the level of acuity because people were avoiding care. I hope that's a boomerang. I hope people become more comfortable of saying, I need to get this checked out. You know, I've had this, you know, ongoing issue. I need to go see someone about this. And we've done a lot of work on our side of trying to engage with our population and say, hey, you know, you haven't been in touch on this issue, we can even do telemedicine, let us know. We're seeing data that's saying, yeah, that's going to be a boomerang. And so those are being addressed and it's slowly coming back, and people are getting more in touch on these kind of ongoing issues that can avoid further acute things. In terms of the Frisbee, I'm hopeful on behavioral health, because I think obviously the pandemic led to a lot of issues around behavioral health. But it also was an impetus to say, hey, we need to come up with a better way to manage this remotely through telehealth. Because there have been a lot of thought, and I'm not a provider, but just engaging with my providers on this discussion, that telehealth, behavioral health through telemedicine would not be effective. And what we've seen is it works in a lot of cases. And so even like talk therapy through telehealth, we've seen it being effective. And so now there's this interest that maybe this solution can work, and let's figure out how we leverage this technology in ways to, you know, take these issues that are just throughout all of our communities and try to triage them. And so one thing I'm really excited about is how do we make sure we're leveraging the right level of care through, you know, various technological solutions to address behavioral health needs. And so some of that might even be, you know, we're exploring potential of using like a chatbot AI program to triage behavioral health needs and say, what is it you need? Do you need, you know, talk therapy? Do you need, you know, psychiatric support through pharmaceutical intervention? Or do you have an acute need where, you know, we need to take you to an inpatient setting or even an outpatient, you know, behavioral health solution? And I'm excited for those because really on behavioral health side, we have the restriction is the supply of providers. And so if we can come up with effective ways to triage those needs and make sure you're matching up the need with the right level of provider or the right level of service, it'll open up, you know, access for everyone to the right level of care that they need. So I'm excited to see that. I hope that is a Frisbee. Telemedicine, it's been a little bit, so broadly telemedicine has been a little bit of a boomerang, but not, I'd say a boomerang that still kind of fell a little bit further down, and we'll probably throw it again and hope it's a Frisbee. Our state, Illinois, has a lot of restrictions around telehealth delivery. Those were loosened through our engagement with, you know, the state legislature and the governor during the pandemic. Right now, we actually have a bill going through our legislature to make a lot of those changes permanent. But I think there's a lot of concern from the payers about what impact it could have on the bottom line. I think there's a lot of data available now, though, to show that, no, telehealth is a good option. It's not going to necessarily increase costs, and it may actually control costs a little bit, but it has to be provided correctly. What I've heard informally from payer feedback is, the large providers like my health system were not the offenders. So we used telehealth appropriately, but they had other groups that may have been more profit driven that did kind of just rack up telehealth encounters that are a little questionable. And so that, I think that's something we're gonna have to work through, but the adoption at the patient level was good. Providers, I think, are more open to it. We just have to give them an effective solution, because right now there are all these solutions in the market and some of them work better than others. And so if we can match up the best kind of telehealth solution with the providers and the patients and then get the payers on board, I think we'll have a great program. And so I'm cautiously optimistic that'll turn into a Frisbee, hopefully. So that's my take on kind of where we sit.
Right. Right now. Thank you. Thanks. We like to end with what we call the quick fire round, which is just a couple of questions, just to get your perspective. The best piece of advice you've ever given?
Don't be afraid to be wrong.
That's a good piece of advice, particularly for young people. What do you do to relax, have fun when you're not negotiating physician salaries?
I used to play a lot of board games, and I used to go to the gym a lot. Now I've got two kids, I guess I lift them and pick them up, and then I also try to get them play games. But I'll figure that one out. It's a five-year-old and a two-year-old, so I'll figure that one out as they get a little bit older, I think.
Every age is a great age, at least that's my experience so far. What advice would you give to your younger self?
Oh, boy. Take chances. It's always challenging, and this goes back to being wrong, you know. In a world, there's always this entropy and always this kind of gravitation towards, not moving down that path and just kind of meandering a little bit, because maybe you feel safer there, maybe it's scary, but no, you gotta go. And so, going back to my career, when I made that jump from law to consulting, that was a big change, but it was the right way to go.
That's great advice. And lastly, if you could change one thing about healthcare, what would it be?
Oh boy. I think we're going to need another hour or two. I would change reimbursement more. I mean, that's what I'm trying to do, right? I'm trying to get us to this kind of value-based proposition, because I think if we can get to more value focused, it'll create alignment across the whole system. And it's less about, churning your cog, and it's more about how do we improve, the overall health of that patient.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. Anthony, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Nigel.
Thank you for joining us today. Please follow us on your favorite streamer and don't forget to rate us, as it helps others find our podcast. Summer has arrived in New York City, and I hope you listen to this podcast while enjoying the health benefits of walking outside. Please join us next time as we tune healthcare. This is Nigel Orenstein in New York.